This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Kate here. This is just an indulgent little plug for an upcoming workshop I'm running for Writers Victoria. It's called The Post-Publication Hustle, and it is all about what comes next after your book has hit shelves. How do you keep it there on shelves in the next year or the next 2 years? How do you keep it in people's minds? We'll do some creative resilience. We'll set some goals. We'll look at strategies for overcoming rejection and failure and all the big bad feelings, and hopefully get set for a cracking 2020. It's on Sunday, November the 10th, 10 to 4 at Writers Vic. Check out the Writers Victoria website or our show notes for booking details.
Okay, Kate, this week we are going to talk about professionalism.
I'm glad that we've both worn our best professional outfits for today's professional discussion.
For very professional. We're going to start with email signatures. I'm really interested in what people put in their email signature. I don't have one. Putting that out there, I've got a Gmail address and no fancy email signature.
That is so
what
funny.
What do you have in yours?
Well, for ages I had the little thing that Black Ink gave me, the skylarking
a banner,
thing.
Kinda.
Yep. Just the picture. And I have something wanky like writer, full stop, educator or something like that. And yep. My phone number.
Yep.
But what I've started doing, when I send from Outlook, I can't see that. Right. So I don't know if it goes. Does it go every time?
Yes. I'm not sure. I don't get it for replies. I feel like I haven't seen it in a long time.
Yeah, because I mostly send from Outlook. But then I had to jump in and like send from in my browser from Gmail
you
the other
very
day.
Set up with
well,
this
it was
Outlook
there. No, the... no, it's all just like there's 5,000 unread emails in my. You know, I am not a good person to discuss this with. But what I found myself doing now is when I have to see it there, my email signature, I just delete it because I'm like, what kind of a wanker are you sending your like 4-year-old book picture out in your email signature? Get over yourself. So that's my self talk to myself. Imagine what people are thinking when they get it.
I don't think they're thinking that.
Well, they're probably not. Like that's.
I wonder if you'll get one for the new book. Will you pursue that or you'll, I mean, obviously you won't stick with skylarking if you have a new book.
I don't think so. That
maybe
would be awkward.
Write off skylarking.
Maybe like, what book? What, first book? What? No, this is my first. I don't know. I haven't thought about it. I generally like to go with trends. So I'll see what the kids are doing. What do you do? Oh, you said
I don't
have
anything.
One. But you would have one for your other real
I
job.
I have one for my real
What's
job.
What's in your real job one?
It has the company that I work for, and then it has, they change the kind of, they use it as almost like a PR educative thing. At the moment it's about, there are only 3 P's that are allowed in the toilet, poo, pee and paper.
Is that what's on them?
Do not put flushable wipes in the toilet.
I mean, I really.
Do not even get me started on flushable wipes.
You know what? Menstrual I totally things, agree with the sentiment. Like I am right there with you. But if so, every time you send
an
email,
yeah, and they're within cute the, little like emotic, like the poo emoticon,
yeah,
and then equivalents.
Wow,
for yeah.
I mean, I
did you know this will be my public service announcement?
Yeah, that's a great public
if
service.
We center. Would be on top of water storages if everyone would save every individual in Melbourne, 3/4 of a bucket of water.
Are you serious?
Yeah, that's what we need people to reduce.
I'm way under the thing. Like the thing that I get from
Still
Melbourne
need
Water.
To save the.
Oh, okay, I'll do it. I'll do it, Catherine. You know what is so funny? It's like we've never seen Catherine do her,
it's
her
not really.
Other self. Yeah, we're seeing it for the first time. Tell us more about poo.
No.
Okay, sorry.
You know I've gotten into trouble about that before.
Okay,
a right. lot of trouble.
Okay, let's
Have
stop.
I spoken about that
no,
before?
No. I was oh like, what God. Do I know? What did you get
I
in trouble
this,
for?
Yeah, I made this. To the Herald Sun, unfortunately. They were interviewing me for something and I made this offhand blanket remark about how gravity sewer is better than pressure sewer. And then
something
some
all
guy,
of us are across.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Who even cares? Why would I have said that? But then some
nervous.
Guy in an area that was being serviced by pressure sewer, by the company that I work for.
Oh my God.
Wrote to the managing director saying Your employee has said that gravity sewer is better than pressure sewer. I don't want to be serviced by pressure. Like,
wow.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
So here is a good example of professionalism.
Exactly.
You are now deciding that you know exactly. You are on message.
Yeah,
is that
work,
right?
We're very nice about it, but they said don't talk about sewage. Just don't. Like, whatever you do, don't talk about it.
It's making me so happy we're having this discussion.
We totally got them on the side.
Okay, email signatures. You know what I don't? Can I just tell you what I don't like?
Yep.
I don't like rah-rah motivational quotes.
People sometimes do that with
just like out of the,
yeah.
Like just,
we're all in this together.
Yeah. So you know what?
No.
Don't do that. Terrible. Should we talk about kisses while we're here? Like, do you do the kiss
like, kiss? Well, I don't do a lot of kisses unless I know the person very well.
That's true. Like, yeah. I am what people who know me will know that I am like, I sometimes put two kisses at the end of each sentence, like instead of a full stop. Not in emails.
I'll do that in text. In text. I wouldn't in email, but I would.
Yeah, but then it's difficult when you go like, I've started going just with K for various people. I mean,
I
it's
love
short.
When people whose name starts with O do that because it's like they're saying, oh. I actually do really like that.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
But so what's your general? I'm a cheers kind of a girl.
Yeah, I would do cheers. Yeah. In text, though, my phone has now got an autocorrect where instead of kiss, kiss, it changes it to a Roman numeral for 33.
What kind of phone do you have?
So an Oppo. Honestly, amazing.
Don't talk anymore until we've got onto Oppo to check if they will sponsor us.
Phenomenal.
Okay, keep going.
I'm not sure. I would never put a phone number because I wouldn't want anyone to call me. I'm totally overstating the fact that people would call me.
That's so funny because I so often go to someone's email signature to find their phone number to call them.
Interesting.
When I say so often.
Daily.
I have done this in the past.
Okay, websites. Let's move to website. Are we done with email signatures?
We're done with email. I mean, we could wax lyrical about email signatures for the entire time, but I think that our listeners want to hear a bit more about how professional we are.
Okay, websites.
Websites.
So we talked a little bit about when we were setting up the website for this podcast.
Yes.
Really, there's two. If you're building a website yourself, and you need a website. We get contacts for the first time podcast.
We do.
I get personal contacts.
Yeah.
The website is
and
amazing.
And the key thing that we were advised beforehand for the podcast, and this is what we've talked about in our recent How to Podcast workshop, is that you need somewhere for the audio to live so that people can also listen to it on their computer. For all those people who go, what do you mean podcast? What's a podcast? Where does it live in my phone? They just want to listen.
The computer for a long time before I
just want to listen on the computer. Process. So that's also an important function of our website.
So the podcast one, we used WordPress. My personal one, I used Squarespace.
Yeah. Apparently Wix is the new thing.
Oh, is
Wix.
It?
Yeah. It's like a drop and drag.
Well, Squarespace is aesthetically a lot nicer, but
absolutely
terrible to use.
Yeah.
And WordPress is the opposite.
Yeah.
Like less flashy, but
functional.
Idiot proof.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is obviously why I went with WordPress. Idiot proof. I'd done a lot of, to be fair, back in the day when I worked at State Library and when I'd done all my web kind of stuff, I did all through WordPress. So I felt much more confident using WordPress.
Yeah, WordPress is a lot.
Having said that, I've run my own, like did my own website for a long time. And just this year it's not live yet, but I have paid someone to upgrade.
I'm interested to hear about that. I got a lot of quotes when the helpline was going out about doing that. And I was on the edge of doing it. And then I can't even remember why.
Oh, quotes.
I didn't.
Decision fatigue, mate.
God.
I'm not getting quotes anymore. I just go with a recommendation.
Yeah, that would be a lot easier.
And
you also
I just
don't necessarily
say,
know what you want. And when they're quoting, they want you to know what you want.
Yeah, that's true. No, I am. And we'll link to. I don't even know the name of the entire company, but the gorgeous man is called Jin, and a lot of authors use this company.
Oh.
And so, you buy the template. Also, all of those decision fatigue things, like going through those templates, like what do I want? Like, you know, you can.
So boring.
And I just decided I did no longer have the time or the interest in doing that part of it. Like, I want to be able to upload new stuff or.
Will you have a blog as part of your website?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know what I really love or have loved in the past about blogging and when other people, if I go back and read other people's blogs, is that I love the timely reading back of the narrative of, you know, the process of this book or whatever. I love I know we linked to a lot of Ben Hobson's blog posts that he did. Sarah
Lee
Schmidt.
Coughlin's
I
just, is a good yeah, one to fall
absolutely.
Down the
so I really,
of.
I really
That's
like
true.
Them. But I've gone to do a couple recently because I haven't done one in about a year on my vlog. And I was like all prepped. I've started half a dozen times, like started the one that says, you know what? I made it. Like the book is actually going to come out. And yeah, I there's something about it that I can't quite write that piece yet.
I have a blog bit on there, but I don't really update it. I'm mainly just recycling content that I've written for elsewhere and just putting it there.
But you are doing a newsletter, are you not?
No, I just link them to your to our newsletter.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Because newsletters are obviously all the what we're supposed
thing.
To be doing,
yeah,
right?
But we're a bit lax on it. We've been a bit lax on the
newsletter. Yeah. I don't think that I would do a newsletter though.
I just link them to this though. You wouldn't
do
that.
Yeah, no, I know. Yep. Oh yeah, maybe. It's just all these things are so tricky.
And
do you look at people's websites?
Not a heap. I always look when we're researching authors for this show. One thing that I think is really good is Nina Kenwood has a list of books I love on hers.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really good way to support other writers. And it's a kick-ass list that she's got. Like I've
amazing.
Been working my way through that list. I saw that Matt Davies, what book did he write? He wrote
This Thing of Darkness.
This Thing of Darkness. He has also been working his way through Nina Kenwood's list.
Yeah,
he said
I saw
on Twitter.
That on Twitter.
Yeah,
I love
it's
that.
A really good list. So I think that is a good one.
I do like when I think probably children's middle grade YA writers do it more when they have FAQs or, you know, writers who
That's
are,
true.
Who get obviously get contacted a lot by students. And I think those things are really useful. I like a good event list.
Yeah, they are hard to keep up to date.
They are very hard to keep up to date, but I do like that. And I think, you know, actually looking at Charlotte Wood's website, if you've got links to people's essays, articles, Alice Bishop does this really well as well, links to their other writing and other times they've spoken, speeches they've done, et cetera. I think that kind of...
Yes, that's true.
It's kind of a press and writing kind of a set of links. I really like those.
Yep.
Mm. On professionalism, hypothetically, you walk into an event which is slightly networking-y.
Yep.
Do you have a business card? Do you?
No.
So what's your deal now? What do you do?
I have actually thought about that because people do business cards. It's sort of like, it's almost like an old fashioned calling card, isn't
it?
But you could have your name and your email.
Well, also I think it's quite awkward. I was at an networking, like literally a networking event the other night that was for RMIT for the graduating class. So they invited a bunch of not quite alumni. There was alumni, but, you know, obviously Catherine and I are not quite alumni because we haven't actually graduated yet. But, and so, you know, there was a bit of like, oh, well, you know, how do we get in touch with you? And so my general thing now is, oh, can I find you on Twitter or Instagram? You know, like I'll follow you follow or find me, follow me and I'll follow you back. And then someone else was telling me, oh, no, everyone's LinkedIn now. You know, you would just do LinkedIn, but
LinkedIn.
I don't
have
do
you
LinkedIn.
Ever, if you sign up for LinkedIn, it interrogates your list of contacts and sends them.
Oh, really?
It's such
I didn't
a weird.
Know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm not like, I don't
sure
really do
that.
So,
doing
that. Can people maybe get in contact with us and tell us, how do you do that awkward?
Yes.
I'd like to follow up because I'm very big on the follow up then. Like, I do
well,
like
follow-up
sending
is
a.
Easy, then you've established it.
Like, lovely to meet you. Would you like to be on the podcast or whatever it is that I tend to do? Can I interview you about, you know, eco-terrorism or whatever it is that I'm interested in.
Yeah.
I do like the old follow-up, but yeah, I was just interested in how people do it these days, how the kids are doing it. We'll find out next time. So I am in Sydney today in the gorgeous Writers New South Wales building, and I'm so pleased to be speaking to John Purcell. John Purcell is a Sydney writer and bookseller under a pseudonym Natasha Walker. John wrote a series of very successful erotic novels and then under his own name published The Girl on the Page in 2018. As director of books at Booktopia, John interviewed hundreds of authors. He lives in Sydney with his wife, two children, and there's a bunch of animals, but I just didn't include them all.
Yeah, there's a lot of animals. Yeah.
Welcome to the podcast, John.
Thank you very much.
So tell us how Natasha Walker came into being.
No.
It wasn't that.
No, long before that.
Okay, tell us what came first.
When I got back from Europe, I was 21.
Yep.
And I decided to sit down and write my autobiography because I lived, you know. I've been around for 21 years.
The memoir.
The memoir. And it was...
How did that go?
Well, I actually ended up being about a relationship with one woman that lasted about 2 months.
Yep.
So the whole novel was about that. A memoir novel, pretty much a memoir, but I just decided to call it a novel. And I had about 30 pages of it for about a year. And I just kept working on these 30 pages. And a friend of mine who was Danish was going back to Denmark and said, look, I'm going back to Denmark. I've read these fucking 30 pages so many times.
Give me more.
Give me more. I want to know what happens. And so I just wrote it. Like with her kind of insistence, I sat down and finished this thing. So I had a book that was, you know, if you printed it all out, it was, you know, 300 pages or something. And it had a beginning, middle and end, and it sort of worked. And I was very proud of it, and I sat back very chuffed with myself. And my father was very excited. He didn't want to read it. My father was very excited. And you know, he sent it off. Like, I don't know. He just sent it off to Jill Hickson, who was Bryce Courtney's agent. You know,
I love it. Thanks, Dad.
Boom. So I got this embarrassing letter back from her saying, you know, that thanks for the opportunity, but fuck off. and he sent it off to Random House. And they were in Milson's Point at that time. I still got the letter. I found it in the box the other day. And it says, you know, thanks for the opportunity to get stuffed.
Okay, so you're building your rejections, as all of us should.
Yeah, and so that first novel kicked around, and I was proud that I'd done it.
Yeah.
And when everyone talks about being a writer, and you know, there's so many writers I knew at that stage who hadn't ever finished them.
Yeah, they've got great ideas. Yeah. Great ideas.
So I was pretty chuffed by that. Then I started, from that point until the publication of Secret Lives of Emma, I didn't finish anything. Like I just started and never got anywhere and never actually completed anything. But I was reading like a crazy person. I was obsessed with writing. I was obsessed with the idea of getting published.
What was blocking you? Was it fear of rejection again? Was it incapacity to be sustained by the ideas?
Yeah, that was largely it. Okay. A fear. Like I often just bit off more than I can chew. Like I had this idea about this this perfect education, and I started it and realized I have no idea how to finish this. I have no idea. I don't know what a perfect education is. I don't even know half the things that I should already know to have it. It's like trying to write Hamlet. Like, I always felt Hamlet was smarter than Shakespeare. Like, how do you do that?
How do you do it indeed?
So a lot of those things were just too big. I remember feeling better about it when I read that Thomas Mann started Confessions of Felix Krull on a young man and decided then that he wasn't mature enough to finish it, so just put it aside. And then came back to it in the last years of his life and started writing again from the same spot. And,
nice.
And you see it. You know, it's got this incredible wealth of experience in it. So a lot of false starts. The Secret Lives of Emma stuff started to become a larger story when I was having great trouble trying to write erotica for about five different people. And they all have different views about what's erotic.
Yeah.
And so my writing was kind of piecemeal. It was never cohesive. The characters had too many things that they liked to be realistic. Until I chose to just decide that what Emma found erotic was what's going to be erotic in this book, I didn't get anywhere. So the Emma stories were stories. They were little episodes of Emma's life.
And what brought you to writing those in the first place?
The competitive spirit.
The competitive, okay.
So I was going out with this girl. She was working in a really boring job. And there's five or six girls in this airless, windowless room at computers. And all they had to do was have the headsets on. And if an automated phone service didn't work, they had to pick up and talk to the customer, right? So they were
there.
Oh,
my God.
Yeah, that was their job.
Soul destroying.
So they were all doing university. They were all just doing their work.
Yeah.
Anyway, so one of the girls, a friend of one of the girls sent in an erotic story to them, and they all read it and they all giggled and I got to see it. And I'm like, I can do better than that. So I sent something in.
Oh my gosh, I love this. This is a story in itself.
Yeah, so, I sent it in and all I got was criticism. Like it just came back with red marks from all the different people and I was like, oh, this is the worst. So I then attempted to try and get the accolades.
So this is your writer's workshop, kind of.
My writer's workshop.
Yeah.
And this is the point where I discovered that I really needed to focus on one woman's needs alone.
Yeah.
And then everyone will either reject her or go with her.
Yeah.
And so Emma arrived from this horrendous process of being beaten about. And because the original guy that sent it in had no aspirations to writing, He was just giving the girls something to read.
Yeah.
I had all these aspirations and they knew about them.
Yeah.
And so they just...
easier to cut you down.
Yeah, and the red lines everywhere. So.
Yeah.
So obviously. I learned a lot very quickly in that process. But then the pages just kept coming in and I stopped sending to them and just kept writing.
So you had a full manuscript then?
Yeah, more than a full manuscript. It was just absurdly long, this story.
And at this stage, are you already working at Booktopia?
No. So that's 2003.
Okay.
So I got to a point where a friend of mine who is an editor, who's now my agent, she looked at it and went, there's so much work to do in this. And they're the words I didn't want to hear. And I went, work? And I just put it in a drawer.
Yeah, okay.
Just forgot about it. Massive manuscript.
Yeah.
I secretly agreed nearly everything she said. I'll never let her know that.
Yep.
And she won't be listening to this, which is great.
I'll get her a copy.
But... I didn't like, hearing it.
Yeah, so of course.
I put it in a drawer. And after that, I started working on this big historical novel, which I kept going at for 7-8 years or something, even after I got published with Secret Lies of Emma. So 2003, put the Secret Lies of Emma manuscript in a drawer. 2012, when most of the manuscript of The Gentleman's Swords, the historical novel, was ready, and I got an agent interested in it, and she started to send it out and was getting rejected on it. She said, and she loved it, and she was sort of like, there's got to be someone out here. Anyway, after a lot of rejections on that, she said, is there anything else you've got in the drawer? And I said, well, I've got this pile of filthy papers. And she said, look, give me a look at it. I like filth. And she read some of it and just wrote back saying, you can go to jail for this. This is obscene.
Unpublishable.
This is obscene. This is no way this is going to be published. It's got some good bits in it, John, but oh my God. And it was pretty much the same week that David Marr had this article in the front of the Sydney Morning Herald about the explosive deal that Random House had done with this obscure independent author, publisher, Fifty Shades of Grey. And so this disgusting pile of papers suddenly became this most valuable asset. And she ran off, and it was about a week later that Random House said, yeah, we'll take it as an ebook and we'll see what happens.
And this is that moment that we talk about so much, which is that there is so much hard work and all this stuff that you do, and then things just, luck plays
massive, such
a role.
And it was not the thing that I wanted. It was so not the thing that I wanted to happen. And I was right there at that moment, and it just... rolled on, like it just had a life of its own from that point.
Okay, so I want to ask you a little bit then about the decision to write that under a pseudonym.
Mm-hmm.
At what point did you was that right from the start, or was that something you did with the agent, with the publisher?
Well, it was kind of mortifying because we're in a post 50 Shades world where we saw Tony Abbott reading it, for Christ's sake. So the world has changed.
Yeah.
And it's coming back, I think.
Yeah.
For a little period there, it changed. But before that, writing erotica was not done.
No.
I started at Booktopia 2 years before. I had gone in as a customer service person because I just wanted another job after selling my shop to get another job.
Yep.
I didn't expect to stay that long. And then saw they needed book people who were book obsessed. They were a whole lot of computer nerds.
And you are nothing if not book obsessed.
Yeah, book obsessed. I was there. Hi. And so I worked my way up. And so I just, at that point, I had a team of people, a small team, but a team of people under me. I was called the head of marketing at that stage. And so I just got that role. And I was the chief buyer. I was the person who saw all the publishers buying everything. So I was kind of a face of Booktopia.
Yeah.
And here I was going to become this grotty, filthy, masturbatory erotic writer. It was all wrong. And I was like, oh, this is not good. And I told Tony, the boss, and he loved it. He thought it was the funniest thing he ever heard. And he was like, we'll support you whatever happens.
Yeah.
But Random House just went, they went down the line of, we need you to be a woman.
Yeah.
Because this is going to help us sell it. And I was like, oh, good.
Yeah, easy.
absolutely, I'm a woman. And that was really there. It came from them as a marketing strategy, I'd say, more palatable. Because it was all about Emma, from Emma's point of view. And they felt the work better as well.
So obviously then the marketing process and your experience as a first-time author that time is going to be really different to what it was when you published under your own name,
yeah.
The Girl on the Page. Tell us just a little bit about what it was like when Secret Lives of Emma came out. Like, what did that mean for you?
It was super exciting, but also super disappointing. it was a massive secret. So close friends knew, but nothing like family, close friends, and very close friends. But everyone wanted to make sure that the fact that there's a man writing was secret. So I had to create Facebook and Tumblr.
And were you doing all that? Because I've read some of your, like, you know, 10 terrifying questions for Booktopia as Natasha Walker. Yeah. Like, doing all of that. So you're still doing the same kind of level of your publicity stuff, but just not live, obviously.
Yeah, I could never turn up to any interview. And that was difficult. And so the things that I was watching other authors at that same time. The books came out around the same time in direct competition with HarperCollins Indigo Bloom books.
Okay.
So I had someone to compare to.
Yeah.
Something I had that she didn't have is I had all the numbers. So when I actually met her 3 or 4 months into it at the Romance Readers Convention, still I hadn't come out. So I'm talking to her. She's complaining about Natasha Walker to me, and I'm telling her the true numbers. Right, so I got phone calls from HarperCollins that time going, you're talking to our authors and telling them the truth.
Don't do that. So did the industry know that it was an industry insider?
No one knew.
So Natasha Walker was just unavailable for interview.
Yeah, and I had sneaking suspicions that there were a couple of weird comments on Twitter from Pages and Pages and from there's a few different Natalie from Double Bay. A few comments. And someone actually came directly to me, a book buyer at a Hachette dinner, came directly to me and said, there's rumour that you're the one that writes this. And I said, I've just taken over my head of marketing at Booktopia. I've got 2 kids. There's no chance in hell I'm writing books. You know, and I just pushed it away. She came up to me about a year later and went, I knew it.
So when do you decide? You decided to out yourself. Is that right? Yeah. So tell us how that happened.
Well, the numbers were going down. The third book came out. It was going away. I'd done everything that we could to promote it, and we'd done good numbers. But it was starting to go away. And I spoke to Random House, and they're like, I don't think there's any more steam in this.
Yeah.
And so I went, great, I don't want to write any more of that stuff. Most of it was from the old manuscript anyway. So it's time to wrap up. So we had Caroline Overington in to sign. And the boss rang her and just said, look, I've got this story. She was working at, she was the editor or arts editor at Women's Weekly at that time. He just rang her and said, I've got this story. You won't believe this story. And she'd met me a few times. And she just, from that moment on, she has not stopped laughing in my face.
And could you then watch the numbers go straight up again?
Straight up again.
And when you're talking about the numbers, you're looking at, you've got much better access to them than the normal author. So you're looking at Nielsen and the rest of it in a kind of more a daily kind of a way to see what the numbers are.
So I can get an indication from the Booktopia numbers because they give a kind of a percentage of the whole.
Yeah.
And so I can see where things are going on those. And they're really at the minute. But then there's the weekly Nielsen numbers that come through.
Okay, so I want to ask you, because we actually interviewed an author recently, I won't name them because we didn't do it on air, who subscribes to Nielsen themselves and can watch their numbers. Is it a good thing or a bad thing?
Bad.
Why?
Because they're always small. Like there's something about all writers, I think, who just can't get to understand how incremental volume is, and seeing weekly is despairing, and it just never seems enough. How am I going to get to 30,000? How am I going to get to 10,000? How am I going to get to 5,000? I'm only selling 150 a week or something like that. But it doesn't happen. It just sort of accrues. But if you're seeing it and you're watching it, and they all have the same, most books, majority of books have the same trajectory. You know, the first 3 weeks are where the biggest numbers are, and the strength of a book is not that. Because that's just publicity, and then it's just word of mouth from then, and some of them will just stay at a nice number for years.
And is that's what we're aiming for?
That's what most authors should be aiming for, but it's extraordinarily difficult to get that.
It's
the book that booksellers feel they have to have in the fiction section
forever
from that day on.
Okay, that's what we're aiming for. Yeah. We'll go to numbers a little bit later too, but while we're on that, in case I forget. Pre-order, the new, I see it as a relatively new thing coming, you know, this idea of a really strong pre-order. What difference does that make? What?
First week sales. So when Barefoot Investor broke the model and changed publishing in Australia, he was following things that were happening in the US. And he knew and it's an old adage of publishing that a bestseller is a book that's selling well because it's selling well, right? And this is that he knew that, he had that in his head, and he mentioned it early on. And he knew first week numbers wake up booksellers. So you get a ton of books shown to you monthly, just so many damn books all the time coming in. And everyone is selling them and saying, this is going to do this, this is going to do that. We've got all this marketing. It's going to be great. It's going to be huge. As a book buyer, as a bookshop, how the hell do you know? You can have, you have instincts. You have, you know, 30 years experience. You have 10 years experience. You have numbers. You have their promises for marketing. You have where they're going to market and how clever they are. All those sort of things. But you're still just a bookseller making taking a punt often. And his book had already been out like years before. Same bloody book, and it hadn't worked. And there he was, like all entrepreneur writers, they all think they're going to be massive, massive stars. And they come in with this really pushy approach. And he did that. And so most of us just went, yeah, so? Yeah, of course you're going to sell me in. It's not going to happen. But then we didn't know really just how obedient his newsletter subscribers were. It was almost like he tested it and sent out an email saying, at 10:30 on Monday, can you all jump? I'll see if I can register the feeling in the earth that you've done this. And he felt it and he went, right, I can do this. When he chose Booktopia, when he sent out his email saying you can pre-order it now with this great deal, with this extra free thing if you do it this way, we had 20,000 pre-orders in a weekend. Which, you know, having a couple of hundred was noteworthy in that time.
Yeah.
So it had 20,000, and we thought it was a scam. We thought, oh my God, Booktopia's been hacked. What's going on? And it was on the weekend, so people had to come in. The genius had to come in and have a look, and that was all legit. They were all single people, all paying with their single credit cards and all different addresses. And we were just like, what the? And so that changed it. And a book that barely any booksellers had taken numbers on, they saw in the first week of publication, 20,000 books ended up on the top of that Nielsen, and they were just like, huh? Weirdly, it wasn't the biggest selling book of that week. I think there was a Harry Potter one. Bizarre, like the chances are very slim in a year to have those two competing. But that's what happened. And from that moment on, it was a success because it just breeds itself. And so from that time, we were actively trying to organize similar campaigns. We worked with a whole range of different authors who had social and good reach. Some did so much better than others. Some understood. But the great thing about anything that Barefoot Investor does is his clarity. His writing has a clarity which to me, just mind-bogglingly clear.
What is good reach, John? You said writers who have good reach. Well, what do you consider good reach to be?
You have with them.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
So I remember years ago, I gave a talk about social media to booksellers years ago at one of the events. And I was talking about Kylie Ladd because that stage she had some about 600 followers maybe more, less than that. But I said, she's engaged with all of them. And so when she says, my new book's coming out, we see the reaction.
Yeah, like, right.
We see the instant thing of 50 copies being sold within hours of that being talked about because she's busily talking to them.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that he was doing, but on a larger scale. He was always interacting with his audience. And so there are people out there who have got, and we've had them published, get so excited about numbers. And so we'll get this American person who has 2 million followers and the book's going to be huge. And we'll be like, well, we've done the analysis. I don't think there are many Australians. Oh, there are thousands of Australians. And nothing. Like no sales. Yeah, they did a post and said, go to Booktopia. And no one went to Booktopia.
Yeah.
So there's reach and there's reach. And there's a relationship. And there's audience that are book buyers and their audience that just never even know what that is. And there's a reason to buy a book version of the content they've got online. Some can cross over.
And some can't.
Yeah.
Okay,
John, this leads us directly really to the girl on the page and what you've talked about that. And I want to quote yourself back to you because in one of your interviews, you described the tension between your secondhand bookseller self, who was wedded to the classics, and your new kind of big commercial bookseller self. And you say, I have become unrecognizable to myself. Tell me about that tension and how it fueled the girl on the page.
I had the more successful I was as a career person at Booktopia, the greater my doubts. Business has always been in my mind. I've always been a radical lefty crazy person.
And we don't think they're crazy on this podcast.
And buying and selling is inherently corrupt. You buy for less, you sell for more. In doing that, you're ripping someone off. Or you're both. And I always feel that. In doing that, you kind of, but because books are holy, and I felt I was in a holy land, bit of buying and selling can't be that bad. It just greases the wheel. And I always told myself that I was doing good at Booktopia because I was helping authors. I was keeping the business aspirations of Booktopia in check to make sure that there was the books were being treated with respect, that kind of thing. And my relationship, I was very strong at Booktopia about relationships with publishers, having good relationships with publishers and having brilliant relationships with authors.
Yeah.
And so that, I was changing the culture of Booktopia, trying to make sure that was front and centre. That's how I felt better about myself. But it went right against the guy who had the secondhand bookshop. I mean, he wouldn't have spoken to me. He would have just shaken his head and walked off. I didn't feel comfortable with these two sides happening, and it worked brilliantly for my writing because I was able to channel that into a book where I could ask the questions of myself through these characters about what it means to sell out, because I was feeling like a sellout. I had much higher aspirations as a writer, as an artist, as a person. I was more of a fundamentalist. I was much more of a Malcolm and Helen than I was ever going to be an Amy. But the Amy side of me was there. I was sitting across from, you know, massive, big-selling authors and admiring them, you know, and that was something that I'd never expected to do. And finding things in their work and finding things in their audience that made it worthwhile and found beauty in it. So I was kind of... conflicted, and that conflict is a conflict.
And I mean, you examine it so well, and I think there's that kind of delicious additional layer that we get as people who are involved in the publishing world, where we are asking the questions of ourselves. I want to know, did you come to a conclusion?
I don't think so. I suppose I did in one way. The final act of Helen in my brain and not many other people's brains is a fundamentalist act. It's an act of someone who understands the life and death nature of art. Right? This is the most important thing. And the shock of it, Malcolm's speech at the end, he's been knocked off centre a tiny bit. He's become a bit more moderate. He wouldn't have given the same speech 6 months before.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to be the moderate Malcolm, but I'm far more the fundamentalist Helen at heart, and old Malcolm at heart. I really do think it's life and death, and there are people out there who mock it. Like, I'm getting reviews of people mock the idea. You know, how can anyone take art that seriously? Blah, blah. And I was like, what else is there? I don't have any other thing to believe in that strongly.
Yeah, it's very interesting because I think we're also at a time, aren't we, where we're being encouraged to like what you've created in The Girl on the Page. You've created a literary, commercial.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a compromise. It is a time of compromise. And so to work out how and where you're willing to compromise on your art, and I think we do a lot of talking about that in the podcast as well, because so often we hear stories about people who are coming through as emerging writers and who are so unwilling to compromise on their art that, of course, that never gets the audience that they want, which is, I suppose, where we are right now with our thinking about genre and not quite being so highbrow about it all.
Well, I was very much like that writer. So all those attempts to write in between the two books were failing because of my unbending nature. And I had lots of very bright people who were pointing out that the books I loved, obsessed about, were as just hard-edged and just as powerful, but had a massive audience. I'm thinking of Persuasion, Moment of View. These books don't pull any punches at all. They're deeper than anything I've ever attempted to write, and yet they're palatable to a mass audience. And they kept reminding me of this, and I just didn't want to hear it. I was not able to sort of deal with it at that stage. But when Girl on the Page came to me, and the crux of it, I knew that I wanted to get as many people into the story, into the meat of it, that I could. And the best way to do that was to write a genre novel.
Yep.
It's a genre novel about high art. everyone.
and I think that's exactly it. I think that you nailed it. I want to ask specifically, I knew we'd run out of time because I have so many questions. At the end of Girl on the Page, you've included the suggested reading list from some of the key players. Was that always a part of it? Was it your decision, publisher decision?
It was my decision. It was something I wanted to do from the beginning, but didn't actually have the courage to actually mention. And I typed it all up and had it there. And just at the end, I just sort of went, could I have this in? And the reaction was great. They're like, why don't we do this all the time? We should be upselling books to everyone at all times. And they loved it and loved the choices. And largely the choices with me being a bookseller.
Yeah.
And knowing my characters and playing around. And the fun bit with Amy choosing Julia's books, that was just so much fun to put together. That's just a book nerd being a book nerd.
Yeah, and tell me, have you got responses from readers saying that they've enjoyed that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Now, around the time, it was like, why doesn't everyone... And even showing booksellers when I went on the tour, they were like, this is the best idea ever. Why aren't people doing this? And I don't know why people aren't doing this. It should be obligatory from now on that all characters have book lists.
Well, it's like that idea of having the playlists that people sometimes put out with their books now as well, have a reading list to go with it. Tell me about the tour. So this is the first time that you physically get to tour with your book. What did the tour look like?
It was very well run, and the publicist organised a couple of days in Brisbane, a couple of days in Melbourne, a couple of days in Sydney. And the bookstores knew we were coming. The timing was great. It was very interesting to be a part of the other side of the process. And I understand why people do like coming to Booktopia to do the thing. It's a safe space. When you're in shops, it's not a safe space. Anything can happen in a shop.
Yeah.
It can be a bit frightening and a bit uncomfortable. And, if a shop is busy and they're mostly busy and there's people doing lots of things, it is a slowing down of processes for that moment in the middle of a Dimmicks in a big Westfield. There you are with a pile of books, annoying everyone by being in the middle.
So what do you do? What are the key things that a writer needs to think about doing in that moment besides being delightful?
Show interest in them. That's one thing. Show interest in books. I buy books when I'm there. I spend a lot of money buying books.
Yeah, okay. So I've talked to people about this before because I often also feel like I should buy books when I'm...
Yeah.
Trying to sell my own book. So you say, yep, that's on your list.
I always, yeah. I mean, it's hard not to anyway. But
it is hard not to, exactly. But at some point the credit card melts. Yeah.
Well, there's wonderful, like you can look around the shop there, like you can get a Penguin for $9.95.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, done.
And there are smaller books at the counter and things like that. So you can sort of show interest without having to break the budget. So that's definitely worthwhile. Making sure you're customer aware as well. I felt like I've spent so many years in bookshops that I was aware and staying out of their way and making sure that if I saw a customer getting angsty, I would tell them, go talk to the customer, not me. That sort of thing. I would make sure that was going on. They're sort of basic things. But, you're a tiny part of something bigger every time you go into these places. So you've got to put that in perspective and not expect the red carpet, not expect any of that. You really just got to downplay any expectations of what you're going to get in the bookshop. Some bookshops, it's a complete different thing. And in others, it's really just a commercial outlet and they just want a signed copy and go away. Some independent bookshops will want to talk to you for ages and you're like, you can have a great chat.
Did your publicist set up events for you? Did you do festivals? What did that look like?
I got a bit of time in the Writers Festival, the Sydney Writers Festival. But interestingly, a book that actually ends at the festival didn't get many festival invitations. And it's all about the literary versus commercial. I think I put this down to a lot of literary types didn't read it because it was too commercial.
Yeah.
And then a lot of commercial types didn't read it because it was too literary.
Yeah. So, okay, so in making that compromise...
Yeah, there's a problem.
There were people that you missed.
Yeah. And I think I probably would have got... and it was interesting the reaction to the authors that got copies. So a lot of the commercial writers got straight back to me.
Yeah.
So I got wonderful quotes from a whole range of commercial writers, but literary authors, not so much. And yet the older literary critics all loved it. So there's a kind of a... It was a bit skewed.
I can see that. And it is. It's got wonderful wonderful quotes. I want to ask you a little bit about those signing moments at Booktopia as well.
Mm-hmm.
I know you're no longer there, but I've asked you if I can ask you for some of the secrets. How many books does Booktopia need to think that they're going to sell for you to get the signing deal with the thingo Bobby behind you?
It's all about the year, time of year. So it could be 50 in the beginning part of the year. And this is where a lot of debut authors have a better shot. So if you're getting published between January and August, you have a much greater shot of getting into Booktopia. If you're getting published after that, in that Christmas period, no chance. I mean, it just won't happen because of the time. We will map out the month and we will be moving everything to see. And it costs a lot for us to do it. There's a lot of people that go down who don't do that job. They go down just to help move the stuff and to make sure the whole thing moves smoothly. So we could have 5 or 6 people who are meant to be doing other jobs down in that room, just helping with the signing. So that's expensive. And in the Christmas months, from August right through, the calendar just gets full. And we'll have to say no to some really big people because we've got 3 on one day.
Yeah.
And at that stage, they're 500 to 5,000 copies. And they can take between 1 hour and 3 hours and sometimes 5 hours to sign. And so it can be absolutely exhausting. Plus, everyone gets a podcast. Everyone gets footage, photos, social media. So be able to get all that out through our small little channels and to find the time to do it all and then come back and do it again the next day, it was overwhelming. So that period is, for debut authors, is very unlikely unless a publisher has gone, this is the debut that everyone's going to be talking about for years to come.
Yeah.
And they bank on it and they put, you can see the amount of marketing they've got going on it. And so then we take a punt. So if you're thinking about the year the Mind came out, we had Holly, we had Trent, we had Christian, we had Chris Hammer.
I love how these people are going down now as one name, like the Madonnas of the literary world. Yeah. And I know exactly who you're talking about. Okay.
So that was a massive year of debuts.
Yeah.
And they all came out in that period before.
Yeah.
It didn't crash into the Christmas period. My book came out in the Christmas period.
Yeah.
Bad move.
Yeah.
I was very excited that HarperCollins did it. And it was a great show of confidence. And I did get a lot more press than I expected to in that time. But their run of debuts up until then, so from I think March until August, bookshops have more time.
Yeah.
Media outlets have nothing to talk about. There's a whole range of things.
You had a great in an interview you did with Valerie Koo for So You Want to Be a Writer, which is a great interview, and we'll link to that. You talk about this need for the great debut story, and the endless line of debuts coming and being sacrificed to the market.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is partly why we do the podcast, because we know what the sell is about the first time. And those ones are obviously ones that really worked.
Yeah.
Holly, Trent,
yeah.
They really worked.
What is the percentage of times that the great debut story really works? Do you think?
I'd say under 5%.
Yeah.
It would be tiny. Because it all comes, there's lots of debuts coming out from all different size publishers with all different size market.
But everyone's hoping. Everyone's hoping for Holly and Trent.
Yeah. And, you know, the Trent thing, I mean, when you look at Holly and Trent, Holly did great numbers, but Trent's done great with a capital. The whole of the word great is in capitals, and it's got a little bling around it.
Yeah.
No one, like, that's just, you know, that's like,
yeah.
Like, when you look back on Australian publishing, things, there aren't many like that at all.
No.
That have done that. And the numbers that he's doing are just
continuing to do.
Yeah. Just, they don't make, like, they're going to ruin people's spreadsheets and their graphs.
What is it? Is there, what's the theory? What's the magic?
The ending. The ending is so uplifting. It is so positive. It's so gorgeous. It's sentimental.
Okay, so you think that this is all about the quality of the book?
Oh, definitely.
But all quality books in Australia don't sell 100,000 copies.
No, I pointed out one major difference. Mine has a bad ending, right? His has a happy ending.
Okay, so you need... So, okay.
It's an uplifting ending. That book ends on a high. If you're on a high and all you remember is how well you felt at the end, you've shoved that into someone else's hand and you know that if you encourage them to get through that first 200 pages, they're going to do the exact same to the next person. And that's what's happened. It's that confidence to be able to hand it over. It's the on-sell. It's the hand-sell from booksellers. It's the hand-sell from
because readers. Of how you feel at the ending. Okay, I had not thought about it from that perspective. I'm going to go back and read it again with that
Dane Austen,
in mind.
Like, how do you feel at the end of Everyone?
It's
so wonderful, that ending. And if you look at most of the books that are well-reviewed and do well, they often leave you not...
You don't win the Miles Franklin with a happy ending.
No. And I've been, since I left Booktopia, I've just been reading like a crazy person. I'm reading all the books that I didn't have time to read because I knew they would sell themselves. Or I didn't read throughout my other career as a secondhand bookseller because I thought they were shit. And I was reading better books. So now I'm reading sort of old Booker winners and things like that. And hardly any of them I can remember have any feeling of uplifted at the end. It's just all...
Okay, this is just notes to myself for book three.
Yeah.
Very good. I want to ask you about money.
Mm-hmm.
There's an article that's doing the rounds at the moment by Heather Dimitriou, who's a US writer. It's called How to Lose $333,000 Without Really Trying, and it talks about money in the publishing industry, and it charts her declining advances. And she's basically saying, someone should have told me this was going to happen, which I don't agree with. And there's a lot of talk about this on Twitter especially. She said, how would my life be different if a fellow writer or someone in the industry had told me that the money I'd be receiving for my advances was absolutely no indication of what I could make on future book deals? So she got sold the dream, and then, you know, the dream doesn't work.
I hate that. Like, I've been dealing with emerging writers and wannabe writers throughout my career as a secondhand book dealer, and they just walk in. And then through email and cold calling at Booktopia. And the thing that gets me, really gets me, is no research. None.
Yep.
Zip. Nada. And I asked them, you know, when was the last time in a bookshop? Oh, I don't. you know, and I knowing what your book is like how do I call, who do I publish? You know, who do I go with? Who do I approach? And I go, what's your book like? Where would it sit in a bookshop? What's the best-selling book in that area? That's the publisher you want then, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, it's not rocket science.
Yeah.
And you just work your way back.
Do your homework.
Yeah, do your homework. And read. The number of people who don't read that want to get published, it's like, get stuffed. You're not allowed in the club if you don't read.
Yeah.
And read everything and read deeply and read, work out what they're doing. Look at the common things that people, writers do, and don't do them yourself.
Yeah.
So if everyone expresses the same... Similarly, or the same metaphor, don't use that. Don't use the same phraseology.
So say you get in the club, and this is what I think Annabelle Smith and Jane Rawson have done so wonderfully in their What to Expect kind of series. You know, what should an Australian writer expect? What range should an Australian writer be expecting in advance?
Don't even think of money.
Don't even think of it.
No, it's nothing. I mean, if you want money in Australia, go get a job. Like, there's no money in publishing.
You're so frank.
Really, there's none. Like, the chances of being Trent Dalton, the chances of being a barefoot investor, so slim. And even then, if you're that bright, why haven't you got a proper job and getting more money anyway? Like, yeah. There's more money to be made in every other industry if you're interested in money.
Yeah.
If you're not interested in money, you're interested in the art, then you just put up with it and you work to make money. Like, there's a whole lot of responses on Twitter to that article where I saw, and all these writers saying, well, I do this, 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 and this to make sure that I can do what I want in my writing. So I have an income.
Yeah. So you're in the camp that says divorce your art from the kind of
And if you want
pressure
to stay,
of making money.
If you want to stay in, lifestyle's a big thing. Yeah, you can dream of the house in the suburbs and the mortgage and the Audis and the rest of it. And if that's your goal, work like they do and get that. Yeah. And your soul will die and everyone will forget about you. You know, just go away.
Not the uplifting end of the interview here.
No, but the great thing about writing is just how wonderful it feels when it's working.
Yeah.
And let that be it. And if the other comes, woohoo.
Yeah.
I sold 60,000 copies of a book in a really short period of time, of three books in a short period of time. I worked the whole way through. There's no way that I was ever going to give up my job to write.
Because you knew.
Yeah, I knew there's no money in it. There's no money in it. No money in writing. I mean, someone like, if you get something into the area of Di Morrissey, she's a very bright woman.
And prolific.
That's a fuck ton of work for the amount of money she's making.
Yeah.
And when she could be doing other jobs and making so much more. I've got a friend now who's making $500,000 a year managing a team. Like, you're never going to get that in writing. If you want that money, don't go to writing. And the book industry is filled of wonderful people who have given up that.
Yeah.
And it's never going to make that much money. Book industry has never, if you look at the history of book selling the whole time, since Gutenberg, no one's ever made money out of it.
Yeah.
It's insane to think you're going to make money out of it.
That's actually, it's kind of a relief to look at it that way.
Yeah.
Stop thinking about that way. I cannot let you go without asking you about writing sex, obviously. Erotica author. So put your Natasha Walker hat on, although Girl on the Page obviously dives in here as well. What are your top tips? How do you write great sex?
Listen. You listen to your partner. Listen to other people of other sexes.
The five people in the room answering phones who are giving you the feedback.
You need to be open to other people's experiences. But then you can't allow them to overwhelm you. So if you're going to write about a character, know what they want, as you might know your partner's desires, and go, that's what they want. They don't want anything beyond that. They want this. And they get turned on by that and that and that, and that's it. That's all they've got. Use that, and then you'll sort of start to create real characters and real desires. And people will put up with it. They might be offended by it because their choices are not theirs, and they like rough sex when the reader likes much more intimate sort of.
And so do those readers just put it down?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think so. I mean, my book, the series got published in Poland, which is hysterical because such a Catholic country. And they have a Polish Goodreads. And my books were hated, absolutely hated. But they write, the Poles write enormous reviews. I feel like essay length reviews. And so I'd get an essay length review telling me how depraved I was and how terrible Emma was and blah, blah, for book one. Same friggin' review would come back and read book two. The same friggin' review would book three. I'm like,
done your job.
You're done. You're like,
you're stuck with this. Yeah. Protesteth too much.
So it is interesting. People do like a little look into someone else's sex life. But when you're writing, you cannot cater to everyone. It just drive you mad.
And then what's the sweet spot between what you've done in Secret Lives of Emma and what you've been able to put into Girl on the Page? Like, how much? I think in one of your interviews you were saying, it's pages and pages of sex scenes versus two pages.
I know, it is.
Okay. So that's partly it.
I actually, in the next format of the book, I've toned down a little bit. From the impression that I got from feedback, was, oh my God, what have I done in this book? And I actually went through it.
In Girl on the Page?
Yeah, in Girl on the Page. And went through it and went, I've actually done nothing. It's all in their heads. Because I infer her life. And they're offended by Amy's life. They're offended by her choices. They're offended by her sexual appetite. From this point on, I would advise don't put sex in books that are going out to the general market. Okay, if you're writing literature for a particular audience, then knock yourself out. But if you're aiming for a big W market, don't put sex in it. Like, unless they're told they're allowed to read sex, like with the 50 Shades of Grey, and it's all okay for that weird period of 6 months in our culture. Otherwise, just don't put it there.
I am going to go and have to have a conversation with my publisher.
Well, if you do, then just have some weak-willed woman being run over by a man.
No, that's not what the scene is.
But that's all they want. They'll put up with that. They cannot have a female who has a sexual appetite.
That is so frightening. Yeah. After finishing their book and writing the best book that they can, mm-hmm. what is the single most important thing that a writer can do to get their book to more readers?
It's all in the contract. So it's such a difficult process getting published that we get so excited and we just sign everything they put in front of you. Oh, God, yes, we'll do that. If there's no marketing behind it and it's not in the contract that there's going to be this particular marketing, don't sign it. There's no point. I got so excited with a publisher taking The Gentleman of Swords after all this rejection that when I actually saw the contract and my agent went through it, she kind of came back to me going, I don't think they're offering things you want. And I looked at it and knowing what I know, I just went, I know what's going to happen in this book already from what I can see from this contract and what they're planning to do with it. It ain't going anywhere. It's a lot of work on my side to make the changes they want.
Yeah.
And I will get nothing out of this. And I've seen those books that publisher has published and just put out on the market without any fanfare in the hope that it goes off. If it doesn't, no loss.
Okay, interesting.
So, yeah, and you can push for it. You can push for specifics about the marketing, what they're going to do, the tour they're going to do, all those kind of things. If they're not willing to do it, then you've got to think about your product. You know, the book is a product in that market. If you are really worried about the book sales, then you've got to know the market and know what is going into that big area, and you've got to feed the market something that they want but slightly different. If there has a newish thing to it. And if you're not getting that response from the publisher, if you're not getting that enthusiasm from the publisher, it's immediate you're not going to get the sales. So they're not enthused, no one else is going to be.
Very interesting. Is there any additional advice you want to give to debut writers?
I think that dreams of writing, if you dream of writing and if you think that your life going on forever is about snatching time to write and to put out all the stories you have within you, and you think that's the only thing you want, then you're a writer. If you're thinking about sales, if you're thinking about fame, if you're thinking about what are you going to wear on sunrise, you're not a writer. Go away.
He's very frank. I've adored your frankness. Thank you so much for talking to us, John.
It's been a pleasure.
All right, John, this is a little tricky for you because, as we're saying, you are a double debuter. So you're going to answer for both of us, for both of your novels, sorry, for the first time quick five, both your debuts. For your first time, agented, unagented?
Agented.
Advance or no advance?
Yeah, there was a tiny advance.
Overseas territories or just Australia and New Zealand?
I think I'd be jailed if it was overseas, but I got Poland and France.
Festival invites or no festival invites?
None, because I didn't exist.
Do you know how many copies of The Secret Lives of Emma sold? You said before. 60,000. Okay, and so let's do it for Girl on the Page. Agented, unagented?
Agented.
Same agent for both?
No, different.
Different. Advance or no advance?
Advance.
Overseas territories?
Not yet, but a couple on the edges.
Festival invites, you said?
One.
One. And do you know how many copies of Girl on the Page sold?
No, not now. I was moving towards 10.
Okay.
But I don't know.
And a question which I'm sure is almost impossible for you, what is your favourite novel by a debut author?
Well, I actually looked it up and tried to find the debut authors. And there's a tricky one which they claim that Jane Eyre is a as a debut, even though she wrote something else before, didn't get published before.
Okay, so all right. Okay, so you can claim that.
Yeah, and Catch 22, which is the book that started everything for me, was a debut, and that is, you know, it's never been out of print. It's just constantly sold, and they've just made another TV show on it. So, and that is a true sort of Boyce Wallace universe kind of debut, where it is so unique, so odd, and it's of its own thing. Mm. So I think I'll put that.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first and second time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe 80. The First Time Podcast is supported by Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, RMIT School of Media and Communication, and by our wonderful supporters on Patreon. You too can become a supporter of our podcast by heading to our Patreon site, www.patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast.